as resident managerette, yes.
How long have you worked there?
I began the day I arrived. No, that wasn't the right answer. The judge frowned.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Smythe.
He took off his spectacles and lowered the timbre of his voice.
Tell me what's happened, Mr. Douglas. You must have a good reason to request a private appearance.
Mr. Douglas cleared his throat.
Your Honor, Mrs. Smythe has been acting strangely the past few weeks. She's been found wandering the hallways, seemingly confused. There have been complaints. Then today we found a valuable necklace belonging to a tenant in her desk drawer. Mrs. Smythe, did you take the jewels?
She shook her head. No, sir. Her voice caught in her throat, and tears burned her eyes. I've had a difficult time of it lately. I've been ill, but I swear I didn't take them. I assure you, someone else did and placed them in my desk.
Why don't you conduct your exam, Dr. Wilde?
The judge waved a hand in her direction. The evidence was against her. She'd lost her early momentum.
Have you been drinking, Mrs. Smythe?
Asked the doctor. No, I haven't.
Have you been taking any laudanum or such drugs?
No, of course not.
Yet Mr. Douglas says you passed out while being questioned at the Dakota, and that you appeared disoriented.
I was, but I think that's just because I've been unwell. Mr. Douglas interrupted.
Look, Your Honor, it's important that this not make the papers. The building just opened, and we can't have current or prospective tenants knowing that there was a thief in our midst. The Clark family and I request that this be taken care of swiftly and quietly. What do you propose, Mr. Douglas, being that you seem ready to take over my job for me?
She saw her chance. Ask Mr. Camden to vouch for me. He'll say that I didn't steal the jewels, that someone else did and made it look like it was me.
How would he know that?
The judge looked at her from under his bushy eyebrows. He knows I wouldn't do such a thing. We are friends, you see. Mr. Douglas shook his head.
She's deluded, clearly. Mr. Camden is a tenant of the Dakota. He lives there with his wife and family. As a matter of fact, it was the wife's jewelry that went missing.
She had no hope. No hope at all. Mr. Douglas shot Sarah a hard look.
Nothing the girl says explains who took the property if she didn't. But we don't want to send her to jail. You don't? No, sir. As I mentioned before, that would attract unnecessary attention. Then where would you like me to send her? Somewhere she can get help. For whatever is causing her confusion.
Perhaps she'd misjudged Mr. Douglas. Indeed, he laid a hand on her shoulder, like a father might. She certainly needed to find out what was wrong with her, if it was the baby causing her befuddlement or something else. If she could avoid going to jail, she could straighten herself out, get well, and then figure out what exactly had happened. Without meaning to, she began to weep.
She is certainly fragile, offered the doctor. So, you agree that she should be sent off? I do, Your Honor.
The judge sighed.
Very well. She can leave for the island this afternoon. They will determine if she can be rehabilitated.
Rehabilitated? Mr. Douglas gestured to the doctor, who pulled out a piece of paper from his bag and placed it on the judge's desk. The judge glanced at it for only a second, before signing it at the bottom.
To the island, then, Mrs. Smythe. And may God help you.
What island? The policeman practically shoved her up into the wagon, ignoring her question. I have a right to know. Where am I being sent? After the judge had made his pronouncement, Sarah was shuttled out a side door and into a transport where a worn-looking woman sat shivering in the corner, wrapped in a dingy gray blanket. The policeman shut the door, and Sarah tried to ask the woman if she knew anything about where they were headed, but she looked back at her blankly. Another girl, wearing garish face paint over a blackened eye, lay against the backboard, mouth open, asleep. The wagon stopped three times, and each time a new mixture of women climbed on board. Two were seriously confused and babbled themselves. Several had terrible coughs that made Sarah worry about her health, but at least it did seem that they were all going to a hospital of some sort. Finally, the wagon stopped. Outside, the East River ran fast and cold. Fierce waves dodged every which way with the turn of the tide. Across the river, a half-dozen enormous buildings emerged through the sleet, spaced out in wide intervals on a thin strip of land. If she got on this island, how would she get off? Panic built up in her throat, but there was nowhere to run, no means of escape. The women, they now numbered about a dozen or so, lumbered onto a boat that strained wildly in its moorings like a chained, rabid dog. On the other side of the dock, 20 men were being herded onto a separate ferry. A disheveled drunk called them all whores before being clocked by a guard's baton. She stared out the grimy window as the boat chugged away from the city. Several stocky officers and two nurses met them on the other side. A list of names was called out. Sarah's was not among them. "I'm sorry, but what is this? Where are we?" she asked the woman holding the list. "This is the charity hospital. If I didn't call your name, stay put." She sat back as the boat headed off to the next stop, another pier several hundred yards north of the first one. A large sign indicated it was a workhouse for petty criminals and the like. Again, her name wasn't called. Sarah looked at the four companions who were left with her. Two of them were the babblers. Finally, near the northern tip of the island, Sarah and the other women disembarked.
"Out you go! Move along!"
Several orderlies herded them toward a five-story octagonal building of white stone, with two wings flanking it at right angles. A windowed cupola on top of the octagon stuck out like an insect's eye. "What is this?" Sarah spoke softly, almost to herself. The woman walking next to her took her hand. "Do you not know where you've been put away?" Sarah looked at her. The woman was young, with kind brown eyes. She didn't wear a hat, and snowflakes dotted the waves of her hair. "A private hospital? No. We're going to Blackwell's Island Insane Asylum." "A madhouse? They thought she was insane. But I'm not mad. Nor am I," said the woman.
"Shut up, you two. No talking."
A nurse the size of a bear banged the girl hard on the shoulder, causing her to stumble. They were brought inside the octagon and placed on hard benches that lined the walls. Sarah stared about her, trying desperately to get her bearings, to make sense of where she was. A wide staircase rose from the ground floor, twisting upward, and she could see doors off each landing. The place was cold, and most of the nurses wore several layers over their uniforms of brown and white striped dresses and white aprons, making them appear much bigger than normal, and quite threatening. One by one, the new patients were brought into a room. When Sarah's name was called, she stumbled in and sat at a desk opposite a man who introduced himself as Dr. Fields. He asked her the same questions as the judge: her name, where she was from.
"Do you know why you are here?"
He took off his glasses. His eyes were bloodshot, with puffy half-moons underneath. She must make them see their diagnosis was wrong. "I was told I needed to go to a hospital, and I think if you'll check, you'll see that I've been ill, and my memory's not been very reliable, and because of that I fell into a bit of trouble, but I don't belong here." I need to rest and get my strength back, and once I'm well, I'll be able to explain what happened. I'm sure of it.
She was rambling on too long. The bored look in his eyes told her he'd heard this before, and was immune to her distress.
Stand up on the scale and we'll take your measurements.
The nurse called out her weight and height, and then grabbed her by the arm.
That'll do. You can go now.
But can I please ask a question?
The doctor sighed.
Yes, Mrs. Smythe.
How long do I have to be here?
Indefinitely, until you are well.
But I am well. Don't I appear well to you? Is there anything at all in my conduct or appearance that seems mad?
Illnesses of the mind are notoriously difficult to cure, I'm afraid. You'll be here until we deem that you are no longer a threat to society, or yourself. Good day.
She returned to her bench and avoided the inquiring gazes of the women still to be called. The cold made her teeth chatter, and outside a blizzard blew up full force, the sound of the wind muting the mutterings of the other women. Her mother had been considered mad. They'd been walking back from church once, when a group of boys caught up to them. One leaped forward, possibly on a dare from the others, and called her the Madwoman of Fishbourne. Sarah had prayed that her mother would ignore them, walk forward. The cottage was in sight, they were close to home. But instead her mother had turned and screamed at the boys until spittle came out of her mouth, her face turning red. They'd taken off, scared witless, at which point her mother had turned to her and smiled.
"That takes care of that, then," she'd said,
as a madwoman might. A bell rang, and a long line of patients made their way down the spiral staircase. Sarah and the other new arrivals stared up at them, taking in every detail. The women didn't speak, just marched with vacant stares until they reached the door of what had to be the dining room. Then they raced off like children, disappearing out of sight. Sarah and the others were told to follow. In contrast to the detailed beauty of the octagon, the dining room was stark, with no decoration or molding. She found an empty spot at a table, where a tin plate and spoon with a piece of bread and a cup of weak tea sat. The bread was stale, the butter rancid, the tea cold. But she forced it all down, knowing that she'd regret missing the meal, and her strength had to be kept up. The nurses stood around, bored, and the chatter of the patients almost sounded normal, as if it were mealtime at a boarding school for girls.
"Bath time for the new girls,"
announced a nurse with an inordinately large head. Sarah heard one of the other nurses call her Nurse Gerlich. Sarah followed the queue upstairs to the very top floor, and into a large room filled with several sinks and three tubs. Her hopes for a hot bath were dashed when she saw the girl at the head of the line, a small thing whose freckles reminded her of Daisy, stripped of her clothes by the nurses. Crying, she was forced into a tub, and cold water was poured over her head, followed by a harsh scrubbing with a sponge. When Sarah's turn came, she took a deep breath as the cascade of freezing water poured over her, into her ears and eyes and down her back. She'd gotten used to taking an unheated bath in England on the warmer summer nights, but this was different, and she cried out in shock. The hard scrub would have almost been a salve to the cold, if it hadn't seemed like they were intent on taking off a layer of skin. Sore and shivering, she got out of the tub and dried herself, before being offered a nubby underskirt and a calico dress. The stains on both indicated they'd been worn by previous inmates. On the back of the dress, in black letters, read, "Lunatic Asylum, B.I., H-6. The dormitory was located down the hall from the washroom. Sarah walked to one of the large windows and stared out into the cold, wintry night. Somewhere out there was the Dakota, and Theo. By now, Daisy had to have reached him, and maybe he was already tracking her down.
Into bed. There's no mooning out the window here.
Nurse Gerlich's massive hand gripped the back of Sarah's neck. She squirmed as the woman shoved her down onto one of the beds, which creaked under her weight. Sarah's eyes welled up with tears.
You have no right to treat us like this. It's inhumane.
The woman leaned over her.
No one cares what you think or what you say. I'll be keeping a close eye on you. Best to keep your mouth shut from now on. Understand?
Sarah nodded.
Now, go to sleep.
The bed was covered by an oilskin and a sheet, with a rough wool blanket on top. She shivered with cold and fear, and when the lights went out, she turned and cried into the pillow. How had she fallen so far? Her sobs subsided, and for a while she had a fitful sleep, until the loud bang of the door pulled her awake. A nurse entered and walked the length of the room, every so often smacking her truncheon on the metal footboard of a bed. Not to get them up, just as a way to keep them from sleep. This occurred 4 times in the night, so that there was no way to get any real rest. The snores and grunts of the other inmates didn't help matters. After the 3rd check, Sarah heard a soft crying in the bed next to hers. She turned her head to see a woman with long gray hair and a face filled with wrinkles. One of the women from the wagon.
There, there. You'll be all right, whispered Sarah.
At the sound of her voice, the woman's cries increased in volume, and several of the other inmates shouted out for her to stop. Sarah quietly slipped out of her bed, wrapping the scratchy blanket around her, and knelt down by the woman. She took her cold hand in her own and rubbed it. The woman's cries softened back to low moans, and Sarah sang softly to her, as she would a child. Soon her neighbor's breathing lengthened. Only when she was certain the woman was asleep, did Sarah slip back into her own bed.
Chapter 18. New York City, September 1985. Here's what I'm thinking we should do. Melinda opened up a glossy architecture and design magazine. She'd shown up on Sunday night on her way back from the Hamptons, grinning from ear to ear, and plunked down at the kitchen table where Bailey was heating up a can of chili. The house where I went to a pool party this weekend had a bamboo divider between the dining room and living room, like this. She pointed to a photo of a minimalist space with a low planter running down the middle, from which 8 or 10 bamboo poles ran up to the ceiling. Some crisscrossed, others were exactly vertical. It resembled some kind of POW jail cell in the jungles of Vietnam. It's very striking, the best Bailey could do.
I know, right? According to Tony, Oriental is coming back with a vengeance. I thought we could tear out the wall between the library and the parlor and put something like this there.
But the fireplace is in the middle of it.
Well, we'll do it on either side.
Let's take a look. Bailey stood up and held her breath the entire way, hoping her instincts were correct. They were.
Shoot. Check this out.
She knocked on the walls to either side of the fireplace. You see how the wall sticks out about 3 feet on either side?
Yeah.
Melinda drew out the syllable, her eyes wary. Well, that's all the flues from the other fireplaces. You can't break through there, which means you'll only get a foot or so of bamboo at the very far right-hand corner, and another foot next to the wall to the living room.
What if we got rid of the door and put all bamboo between the flue and the left-hand wall? That's like 5 feet of bamboo.
Do you think that would look right? On only one side? The symmetry might be off. Melinda wasn't so easily dissuaded.
Well, check with Steve, see how much it will be, and we'll go from there.
Of course. I'll let you know what I hear back tomorrow. They wandered back into the kitchen.
You were pretty messed up on Friday night. You doing okay?
Bailey went to the stove and stirred the chili before turning off the heat. Her face probably burned the same color as the flame. I'm fine. Need to stop that from happening again. I guess I shouldn't have invited you out. No, it's not your fault. I need to get tougher with myself. She turned back. Did I make another huge scene? Melinda shook her head of blonde curls. Not at all. We hung out down in that room the whole time. You were perfectly well-behaved, if rather fucked up. I tried to tell you to stop. Had she really? Bailey couldn't remember that. Melinda was the type of person who drew power from others' frailty, and Bailey was vulnerable. Had been for a couple of years now. But thoughts like that were ungenerous and unkind. Look how much Melinda had done for her just this past week. Time for a change of topic. Hey, what do you know about how your great-grandfather died? Not much. Just what you know. He was stabbed in the library with a knife. Like a game of Clue is how it always sounded to me. Don't you think? It does. But what about my grandfather? Did your mother say anything about who he was or how he ended up a ward of the family? Not that I remember. They did that all the time back then. You had orphans, and they got raised by someone else. It was the right thing to do. Otherwise, he'd have been dumped in some orphanage, and then where would you be? If her grandfather had been raised in an orphanage, there was a good chance she'd be right where she was anyway. Broke, an addict, a loser. What do you know about the woman who killed him? You're quite the history buff. Where's all this coming from? Bailey explained her expedition to the basement and the discovery of the trunks. She didn't mention Renzo's part in her investigation, since that would probably make Melinda shut right down. She also didn't bring up the sketch. Not yet. It had been passed down on Bailey's side of the family, and for now, she wanted to keep it to herself. I found an article about the killing as well, from the 1880s. It said that the woman who did it had worked at the Dakota, that she was insane or something. Also, there's this photo. Hold on a sec. She plucked it off the windowsill in her room, where she'd perched it next to the bottle of Dr. Walker's vinegar bitters, and handed it over to Melinda. Who are these people? If you turn it over, it says that the woman is Sarah Smythe, the lady who killed Theodore Camden, standing with Theodore's son and two daughters. The boy is your grandfather, Luther. I'm pretty sure this is the ward, my grandfather, in the woman's arms. Huh. This was in the trunk? Melinda looked up at her, and it wasn't her normal, I'm so pretty and want to make sure you're looking at me, glance. She was studying Sarah's face, her eyes flicking from feature to feature. She'd noticed the resemblance, just as Renzo had. Bailey pointed to the photo. This seems crazy, but don't you think I look like her? Melinda placed the photo on the table. Not really. She's harsh-looking, and you're such a sweetie. Black-and-white photography along with corsets will do that to a girl. Bailey took a deep breath. This may be a long shot, but what if Sarah Smythe was Christopher's mother? I'd love to find out why Theodore Camden and his family took in the kid of someone who then killed him. Who knows? Melinda chewed on the inside of her mouth. Sounds like a bunch of Looney Tunes. Maybe Theodore Camden was the father of the kid. There. She'd said it. That it was a crime of passion, not madness. Melinda shook her head. Ugh, now I'm just confused. Her resistance only increased Bailey's fervor. Sarah Smythe looks like me. A lot. I know you see it, too. That's not all. See the outfit the baby is wearing? It was in Sarah's trunk, not Theodore or his wife's. Sarah's. So they raised this woman's child because she wasn't married. Seems really generous of them. But it doesn't mean Theodore Camden was the father. Melinda put her hand over Bailey's. Does this make you miss your mother? The non sequitur threw Bailey for a moment, but then it clicked. If Bailey was the great-grandchild of Theodore Camden, then she was also a threat. By sharing the family legacy, she might also deserve a share in the family trust. She refused to be deterred. I do miss her. But seriously, what if Christopher was the love child of Sarah Smythe and Theodore Camden? Melinda yawned, obviously bored with the subject. It's not General Hospital. The lady was a freak, a sociopath. No way do you want that hanging over your head. Like I'm not enough of a nut already? You've had a tough time. But I think right now it's important for you to move forward, not back. All that happened a long time ago. Let it lie. My mom and dad were horribly embarrassed about the notoriety of the murder. No one wants to talk about that. No one but Bailey. If only she had the courage to show Melinda the drawing. No, not yet. The evidence was still flimsy at best. Melinda snapped her fingers. In any event, I totally forgot something really important I wanted to tell you. Yes? Koi Pond. Bailey offered a polite smile, hoping Melinda would eventually speak in a whole sentence. What about it? She clapped her hands together like a little child.
We're going to put one in the living room. How cool will that be?
So cool, Bailey sighed. There would be no more talk of Sarah Smythe. Sunday evenings were usually quiet in New York, as families retrenched for the coming week, and the streets were fairly empty, except for a group of guys slouching outside the bodega on 71st Street. Even though Bailey knew it was smarter to cross the street than get too close, tonight she couldn't be bothered, and she took their nasty words in stride, staring straight ahead, shoulders hunched, like she deserved it. Bailey practically ran up the steps to the AA meeting at the church on 69th Street, avoiding any eye contact with the people standing outside, smoking and chatting, and took a seat near the back. Everyone seemed to know one another, and she was content to listen to their snatches of conversation rather than join in. The room was warm and close and smelled like smoke and burned coffee, but that didn't bother her. She took a deep breath and joined in the serenity prayer. When the time came for people to share concerns of the week, Bailey lifted her hand. The chairperson, a woman of about 60 with bright red hair, nodded in her direction. Bailey spoke without making any eye contact, her gaze directed at the front wall. I was recently in rehab, but I went out and drank on Friday night. I put myself in a situation where I knew I might drink and do coke, with friends who I knew would drink and do coke. She shook her head. Stupid, I know. But I guess, in a way, it was good. It showed me just how precarious I am in recovery. It's not a joke, a passing phase. If I drink, I can't stop. Her throat strained from the effort of keeping the tears at bay. I'm not in a good situation at the moment, and I'm not sure how I'm going to manage. But it's helpful to come here and hear your stories, and I thank you for that. Keep coming back, the phrase echoed around the room once she'd finished, and the man sitting next to her offered her a tissue. She took a deep breath. The best thing about meetings was that you could vomit up all your thoughts and feelings and crap, but you didn't get advice in return, just acceptance. That's what she needed right now. At the end, Bailey tried to sneak out, but got caught in the bottleneck near the door. The red-headed woman touched her on the arm and pressed a pamphlet for newcomers in her hand. Bailey thanked her and folded it in half, embarrassed by the attention.
Hey.
She turned to see Renzo right behind her. Oh. Hi. When she'd first arrived, she'd glanced around the room to see if he'd come, and been relieved that he hadn't. She knew she wanted to share, but didn't think she could do it with him in the room. Hopefully, he'd arrived late and missed her pathetic whining.
I appreciated your share.
No such luck. I guess I have a lot to learn.
Don't we all?
Great. Now the guy knew what a fuck-up she was. He was probably one of those book thumpers, sponsoring people right and left, an all-knowing guru of all things sober.
When did you go to rehab?
She laughed. Got out a week ago. Nice, right? The words came out harsher than she meant them to, and she could have sworn he flinched. She sounded coarse, like a New Orleans tramp in some Tennessee Williams play.
Took me about a day to start back up again. So don't beat yourself up.
She looked up at him. His expression was soft but guarded, and his eyes didn't quite meet hers. He didn't seem like a self-righteous counselor type. He was as nervous as she was. You were in rehab?
Not exactly. I went to Alaska. I figured out in the wilderness I'd get dry.
What happened?
Turns out Alaska is full of bars and luscious. Not much else to do there.
You lasted a day? I'm impressed. She'd forgotten what a relief it was in rehab to laugh at the absurdity of it all. Renzo shrugged and hooked a thumb toward the door.
Want to grab a hot dog on the way back?
Okay. This time, as they strolled by the bodega, the guys outside yelled out to Renzo by name.
Yo, Renzo! You got a girl now? Nice going. Mind your own business, Mortimer, and go home and take care of your own woman.
The man cracked up, shaking his head.
Yeah, right. Mr. Renzo, she's a fine one.
Mortimer? Bailey waited until they were out of earshot. Is that really his name?
We used to play together in Central Park. As we got older, we'd steal beers from that bodega and go drink there instead of play.
Outside Gray's Papaya, a sign read, Recession Special. $1.95 for 2 francs and a medium drink. Bailey pointed to it. Aren't we out of the recession?
I think they just can't be bothered to change the sign.
I like that. Everything else changes so fast. Especially in New York.
Not Gray's Papaya.
He ordered the hot dogs and handed one to Bailey. While he paid, she pumped mustard in a long, thin line out of an enormous plastic tub. Delicious. The hot dog snapped when she bit into it, and the piquancy of the mustard made her smile.
You look happy.
This is amazing. I guess I'm a cheap date. She regretted the words as soon as she said them. This wasn't a date. You live in the Dakota?
I do. My family's been there for years. My grandfather was a porter. My dad became super. Then me.
Where's your apartment?
I'm on the first floor, west side, facing the courtyard.
So you can keep an eye on the neighbors?
That's a good way of looking at it. Some sunlight would be nice, but it's not a bad address to have.
Was it fun? Growing up in the Dakota?
Sure. Even though it's a lot of wealthy folks, it's different from what you find on Park Avenue. Lots of singers, actors, producers. People who are loaded, sure, but also have an artistic bent. I don't know how long that'll last, though. The city's changing fast, and there are tenants like Melinda who just don't care.
She really should stick up for her cousin, but she couldn't help herself. Now she wants a koi pond in her living room.
I can see why you needed a meeting tonight.
A lump built up in her throat again. Did she have the courage to tell him what was really bothering her? The quiet hum of the street noise and the darkness enveloped her, made her feel safe, as did walking beside Renzo. And yesterday was the anniversary of my mother's death. Renzo stopped. He didn't attempt to make any comforting movements or noises. Just stood still.
What happened?
She took a deep breath, close to bursting into tears. 12 years ago? I was 18. She was on her way home to celebrate my dad's birthday. Car crash. Talking about the subject, which was taboo at home, was difficult. Saying the words out loud made it real. She didn't want it to be real. I'm so sorry. I guess it's better I'm eating hot dogs instead of hitting a bar for a drink, which was my first impulse this afternoon. My mom died too, but when I was little, I didn't really ever know her. For a few seconds, Bailey stared, unabashed, into Renzo's face. Words were inadequate and unnecessary. Renzo broke the silence.
How did you manage after she passed away?
I went off to Parsons, studied, partied, pulled away from my dad, as he did the same to me. It's taken me this long to realize there's only so much running you can do. It's weird, but seeing that photo helped. She confided in him about the drawing, with its secret inscription, and Renzo's eyes grew large.
That's an interesting turn of events.
I know. Somehow imagining I'm a descendant of the love child of Theodore Camden and Sarah Smythe makes me feel a little better.
Like you belong to someone.
Yes, exactly like that. Then Melinda and I would be true cousins, not fake ones.
You sure you want that?
Yes, and not just because it might come with a share of the Camden Trust Fund. I want to feel like I'm part of a legacy, that it's not just me spinning alone in the world.
Then again, who knows what happened in the past? Maybe it's better it stays that way. If it were up to me, I'd put my money on it, just on that eyebrow thing.
He touched her gently on the temple, and she flushed with self-consciousness. She took a couple of steps back, the moment broken. How did you end up back here after Alaska?
I never imagined I'd come back to New York, but when my dad passed away, it seemed like a good thing to do, until I figured out my life.
She wasn't the only one hiding out at the Dakota and licking wounds. And did you figure out your life?
I guess. I love the building. Not all the tenants, but some of them. Sure, every so often I get treated like I'm an idiot who only knows how to unclog a toilet, but it's an honor to live there.
That's lovely. He blushed under the lamplight.
Not something I tell most people. Don't want them to think I'm a puddle of mush.
Puddle of mush? Anyone who uses that phrase is indeed a puddle of mush.
You know what I mean.
In fact, I do. The building soared above them, and they both paused and studied its grand facade.
She's a beauty.
Even without looking at him, Bailey could hear the smile in his voice.
Chapter 19. New York City. January 1885. Breakfast the next morning was a chunk of stale bread, along with some tepid brown liquid that one of the other inmates referred to as cocoa. Sarah downed the brew in one gulp and gnawed on the crust until it became soft enough to swallow. Today she'd explain that she was not one of the dribbling ladies or maniacs, that they'd made a mistake. In fact, she'd awakened this morning feeling better than she had in several weeks. The headache and lethargy had dropped away. Her clear-headedness had come too late to save her from the trip in the tub of misery, as a nurse had referred to the ferry boat this morning. After breakfast, they were again made to sit on the benches in the octagonal room. No movement, no speaking. Sarah took the time to study the interactions of the nurses. There were five that day. And the doctor. Four of the nurses were stolid, nasty sorts, but the youngest one hadn't yet turned bitter. Her interactions with the inmates were calmer and more patient. Sarah heard her referred to as Nurse Alden. Dr. Fields preferred Nurse Alden, and seemed to go out of his way to speak with her instead of the others. Many of the other patients were foreign and had little or no mastery of the language. Sarah was certain the majority of these were also of sound mind, but hadn't been given the chance to plead their cases in their mother tongues. Of the others, the ones who spoke English, a few babbled to themselves endlessly, at the risk of being on the other side of a striking hand. And some were nasty, stealing bread from others' plates, or grabbing themselves inappropriately. Sarah avoided eye contact with them, pulling into herself when they passed, trying to be invisible. A bell rang, and the group was herded outside into the January morning, where hundreds of other women huddled against the building or valiantly walked the grounds. Sarah marched to the water's edge and stared across the gunmetal waves of the East River at Manhattan. In the cold, clear air, she found what she was looking for immediately. The Dakota. The three triangles that made up the east roofline pointed into the bitter sky like beacons. She wondered if Theo had gone up onto the promenade to see if he could find her. He must be mad with worry. No doubt as soon as he figured out where she'd been sent, he'd get her released. It was only a matter of time.
No point staring at this city. We'll only make you sad.
A woman with olive skin and black hair stood close by, arms wrapped around her chest for warmth. She looked to be around 40 years old, with creases like kitten whiskers across her cheeks, and a streak of gray in her hair.
I am Natalia.
Her foreign accent made the word sound delicious. Or maybe Sarah was just hungry.
I'm Sarah. Sarah Smythe.
You got here yesterday, right?
I did.
Sarah looked back at the asylum.
Don't worry. No one's in sight. They hate going out in the cold. So this is one of the few times we get for freedom.
They began walking together along the pathway.
How long have you been here?
Sarah asked, fearing the answer.
5 years, I think. Non lo so. Time gets lost here.
The blood drained from Sarah's head. She wouldn't make it another week, never mind 5 years.
Why were you sent here?
I stole some jam from my employer, a rich signora on 20th Street. I worked as a kitchen maid. My kids were sick. I could sell it for their medicine. She searched me and found it, and when I told her what I thought of her stingy ways, she had me committed.
How could she do that? You seem perfectly normal to me.
I see that in you as well. How are you here?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I'd been feeling off the past month or so.
A hand went to her belly, a reflex.
I work for a large apartment house, and when a necklace went missing, they insisted I'd taken it. But I have no memory of it. How can that be?
You seem a sana demente to me. A very good, a very smart.
Natalia's bright comment lifted her spirits.
I feel that way as well. I'm going to explain that to the doctor today.
Natalia stopped.
Best not to. They don't like the idea that they are wrong.
But I can't stay here another minute.
Take care.
Natalia blew into her cupped hands, the spectral steam escaping through her fingers.
If you make a fuss, they put you in the retreat or the lodge. You don't want that.
What happens there?
They're the wards where they put the worst, most violent patients. You're in danger if you end up there.
I won't be violent. That's the whole point. I'll be civil and logical. I'll show them that I'm sound of mind.
Natalia didn't respond. Another bell rang.
We go inside.
As they retreated back inside, a thought occurred to Sarah.
What happened to your children?
I don't know.
Do they know that you're here?
Probably no. I didn't even know where they were taking me.
Nor did I. If she had known, could she have done anything to change the mystifying turn of events? If she'd kicked and screamed, she would have ended up in jail. Poor Natalia, having to leave her children to fend for themselves. She struggled for something kind to say.
You speak quite good English.
I listened carefully, picked it up fast when I came from Italy.
They stood in a line behind the other inmates, funneling back inside the octagon. Like hens going back to the hen house. It's wrong what they've done. To you and to me. An injustice.
Natalia laughed. Do you think we band together, fight back? No good.
We must do something.
Others have tried.
How?
Natalia made a motion with her arms. Swim across to escape. Drowned.
Sarah looked back at the frigid expanse. Even in summer, powerful currents roiled the brackish water, as if giant sea serpents thrashed just below the surface. They were getting nearer to the door, and Sarah was reluctant to enter. It was such a comfort to speak with someone, someone who understood. Ahead of them, a young girl with matted hair and a sweet face garbled out a song.
An idiot. We have many, said Natalia.
The girl's song faded out into a hum.
But at least she doesn't know where she is. I am jealous, sometimes.
Lunch was a chunk of rancid beef, eaten with the hands due to the lack of a knife or fork. One boiled potato, a bowl of soup, and another piece of bread. Sarah was so hungry by then, and chilled from the cold walk, that she ate and drank as much as she could, trying not to look at the greenish tinge of the bread crust. The strength in her appetite gave her hope for her general health. As the past couple of weeks, she'd been unable to eat much, and figured that had contributed to her mental lapses. The work assignments that were handed out at the end of the meal offered a chance to move around and get the blood flowing again. Sarah was assigned to scrub the octagon stairways with a half dozen others. Nurses handed over buckets and brushes, and the women spread out, each taking a landing and a stair. Although the water made her fingers cold, the joints in her shoulders and knees welcomed the activity. She looked up at the skylight high above her. Theo would have appreciated the grand Ionic columns that lined the balconies.
Keep on scrubbing!
A nurse glared at her from the balcony above. Sarah went back to her work, and even though her staircase was finished in 30 minutes, she noticed the other women stayed at it, going over what they had scrubbed before, so she did the same. It wouldn't do to attract attention by announcing that the job was done. As she was working on the lower steps, a couple of nurses walked by.
Superintendent Dent is due in an hour. Dr. Field said to lock up the noisy ones until he's gone.
They'll miss supper.
No matter. There'll be another meal tomorrow.
At this, she laughed. It was Nurse Gerlich, and she caught Sarah staring.
What are you looking at?
She stepped over and placed a dirty boot on the step Sarah had been working on.
Clean that up, will ya?
The other nurse guffawed, and they walked away. Superintendent Dent. Sarah would pick her moment and approach him, tell her story. Even though she was no longer wearing black silk, and her hair was braided down her back like a schoolgirl's, she still had the accent and the countenance of a good English girl. She'd stop him in his tracks, raise one eyebrow, and ask for a private moment. It had always worked before, and she knew it was best to do so now, as a fresh arrival. With renewed energy, she scrubbed off the dirty footprint, and when the next bell rang, she followed the other girls, dumped the dirty water outside, and stacked her mop and bucket on the landing. They walked out into one of the wings, and entered a long room with tall, barred windows along one side. Severe-looking yellow benches ran along each wall. Most of the women rushed for the seats opposite the windows, and only later did Sarah realize why. They were to sit for hours at a time. If yesterday's wait to be seen by the doctor had been excruciating, it was a mere blip in a day compared to the afternoon's torture. Sarah took up a bench under one of the windows, a cold wind blowing on her neck and down her back. The women who sat across from her looked out the windows, their eyes lifted to the light like churchgoers to the cross, while she had only their worn faces to watch. If a woman shifted in her seat, the nurses, all sitting around a table in the middle of the room, would yell for stillness. No one spoke, but a couple of inmates dozed off while remaining upright. After an hour, Sarah did indeed wonder if she was mad. She wanted to stomp out of there, yell at the top of her lungs. Her eyes played tricks on her. The light in the room changed from gold to green to blue. When she closed her eyes, the color still shimmered behind her eyelids. If she wasn't careful, she'd lose her mind here anyway, and it would be no different than if she'd been mad in the first place. The door opened, and a man in a black suit with white whiskers walked in. The nurses all rose.
"Superintendent Dent, welcome," said Nurse Gerlich. "Ladies, thank you."
He put a hand in one pocket, and with the other fingered his timepiece, as if he were worried it might be grabbed off him at any moment.
"How do you do?"
The superintendent walked the full circle of the room, hardly pausing to hear an answer. Not that he got one. Few women dared speak, other than to say, "Fine," and "Thank you, sir." As he headed along her row, Sarah braced herself. She had to say something, now. She opened her mouth to speak, but Nurse Gerlich cut in.
"Superintendent Dent, I hate to cut your visit short, but Dr. Fields was hoping to get 5 minutes of your time, if you please."
"Of course. Lead the way."
Nurse Gerlich shot Sarah a nasty look as she turned. The woman knew exactly what she'd been planning, like she'd read Sarah's mind. She might have won this round, but Sarah would outwit her. She had to. More sitting. With the dregs of the supper settling badly in her stomach, Sarah took a seat between Natalia and the woman with the long gray hair who'd cried in the night. Sarah tried to make eye contact with her, to make a connection, even if it was by blinking. But the older woman only stared down at her feet.
"So cold."
It was only a murmur, but in the silence of the room it sounded like a scream. Sarah made a soft shushing noise. The nurses were just outside the door, jabbering on about a new dress shop that was opening up somewhere in Manhattan, which might as well have been Russia. It seemed so far away. Oh, for the luxury of speaking of dress shops, something she'd taken for granted before being thrown into this dungeon of filth and misery. How she wished she'd not been too caught up with the pettiness of daily life to appreciate such freedom.
"Cold. My feet. So cold."
Sarah leaned close.
"I know. We'll be done sitting soon and we can go to bed. But no more speaking."
The woman looked up at her with trusting eyes.
"It's all right. What's your name?"
Sarah whispered.
"Marianne."
The woman must have been lovely once, the bone structure of her face sharp under paper-thin flesh.
"It's a beautiful name, Marianne."
Sarah took the woman's hand in her own and rubbed it.
"No. No. Cold."
Her teeth chattered in between the words.
"No talking," said Natalia from the other side of Sarah. "You'll get us all in trouble."
Sarah kept a hold of Marianne's hand.
"She can't help it." Without warning, Marianne leapt up from the bench. She whirled around and began hopping, her hands crossed tightly over her body. Her mouth opened wide, and a guttural yowl erupted. Over and over, she screeched out her anguish, the sound echoing around the vast room. The nurses charged in, Nurse Gerlich leading the way.
"What's going on?"
Marianne ran to the far side of the room, still hopping and howling.
"She's cold," offered Sarah. "Don't say a word,"
Natalia, speaking under her breath. But it was too late for that. Nurse Gerlich turned on Sarah.
"Quiet!"
Unused to taking commands, Sarah stiffened. "She's simply cold. Is there any way she can get another covering? A blanket? Please, you can see how thin she is. The cold goes right through her." Marianne was busy evading the grasp of the other two nurses, running around the table with them trailing her. Nurse Gerlich stuck out her arm, which was the size of a tree branch, and grabbed her by the throat.
"You about finished there, dearie?"
Marianne nodded, but when Nurse Gerlich loosened her grip, she screamed louder than Sarah would have imagined possible. The sound came from her very core, embodying all of the hunger, cold, and hopelessness of the place. Many of the inmates shrank from the sound, but Sarah stood.
"You must help her!"
Nurse Gerlich laughed and shoved Sarah back down with her free hand. She turned to Marianne, studying her like a wicked child would an injured butterfly.
"I hear this one used to be a dancer, back in the day."
Marianne's arms dropped to her sides.
"That got your attention, didn't it? I think you should dance for us then, since you're incapable of sitting still like the rest of the patients."
Marianne shook her head.
"Dance, or don't eat for 3 days."
Sarah flinched, ready to spring to the woman's aid, to try and distract the nurses. But Natalia grabbed her arm.
"Don't do it. Stay put." "Dance. Now."
Marianne hopped like a robin, wary and watchful.
"That's not dancing. No dancing, no food."
Tentatively at first, the woman began moving her feet in dainty steps. Then her hands fluttered, and she hummed a tune under her breath.
"That's right. Keep on."
Nurse Gerlich stared hard, licking her lips. Marianne's movements became stronger, her arms wide out, then up above her head. Her legs extended in long, clean lines. For a moment, Sarah forgot where she was. The bare room might as well have been a London stage, and Marianne a debut ballerina in a skirt of layered gauze. Her hair whirled about her as she spun on one leg, the other wrapping around and back out, the momentum turning her around and around. She finished and gave a low bow, her aged body still limber, the steps fixed in her memory. For a moment no one stirred, mesmerized. Nurse Gerlich indicated for the other nurses to sit, and took a seat herself at the center table. No doubt the dance had transported them away from the mundane tasks at hand, to a place where beauty and kindness were still possible. But when Sarah got a glimpse of Nurse Gerlich's profile, her heart sank. A vein throbbed on her forehead. Her eyes shone with a shrewish ferocity. The unexpected grace of Marianne had enraged her further.
"You'll keep dancing until I say you can't."
Marianne did so, but less committed to the steps this time, her eyes never leaving Nurse Gerlich's face. After 10 minutes, she had become a ghost of her former self, all energy sapped by the unexpected exertion. After 20, she fell to her knees. The bell rang, but Nurse Gerlich put up her hands, and everyone stayed seated.
"More dancing. Jump around like you were doing before. You're pathetic. A weakling. A sad old lady."
The other nurses joined in, teasing and laughing at the woman. Tears slid down Marianne's face. Her mouth was slack with exhaustion.
Get up, you old bitch. Get up.
Sarah silently willed for the woman to do so. They had to be excused soon, and then she'd take her upstairs to bed and tuck her in, show her some kindness. Marianne was on her hands and knees, trying to get a foot under her to stand, when Nurse Gerlich strode over and shoved her with her boot so hard she collapsed on the stone floor.
Enough!
Sarah raced to her side, not caring what happened. If only all of the other women would do the same, they could overpower the nurses, take over a boat, and ferry themselves to safety and sanity.
You're the maniacs! How could you do this to a poor old woman?
She held Marianne in her arms and looked up. Nurse Gerlich's expression, which she had expected to be full of hate, was not. Her eyes shone. Her cheeks burned red. She was happy. The thought of having another person to torture was a pleasure in her sick mind. Physical pleasure. The thought turned Sarah's stomach. Her baby. The world slowed down for a second as she saw Nurse Gerlich's black boot draw back. But she didn't have enough time to protect herself. The impact landed on the exposed side of her torso, hard, her body sliding a few inches across the floor. Her breath left her lungs in a rush, and she groaned, releasing the woman and wrapping her arms around her own belly. The next kick struck her hip bone, reverberating through her pelvis. A deep-throated cackle was the last thing Sarah heard, as Nurse Gerlich's boot connected with her temple. Chapter 20. New York City, January 1885. Sarah stared out of the window into another bleak dawn. She'd been locked up for 5 days now, and other than resting on the cot, allowing her sore ribs to heal, she spent hours standing at the window. During the day, she could hear the shouts of the nurses rounding up the inmates after their walk, but other than that, no human noises reached her ears. Her meager ration of food was shoved through an opening in the bottom of the door. For the first 2 days, the silence was a respite from the commotion of the place. But now she was desperate for a human touch, a smile, something that acknowledged her presence in the world. By the third day, she'd looked around to try to find something with which to kill herself. But the bed had no metal springs, nothing sharp. She considered smashing her head against the bare walls. The door to her room was opened, and she jumped at the sound, her ears unused to the squeaking of the hinges.
Mrs. Smythe, you're out.
I'm out? A burst of joy collected in her throat. Had Theo finally come? An unfamiliar nurse smiled. A missing front tooth gave her grin a menacing air.
Not out like that. You're back on the main ward. Back to Hall 6.
Of course. How stupid to think she would be released. But being with the other women was a consolation. Natalia pulled her over to sit with her at breakfast and insisted Sarah eat her own piece of bread.
We must build you back up. You look like a ghost.
Sarah dutifully nibbled at the hard crust. What happened to Marianne? Natalia shook her head.
They took her away. I hoped maybe you were together.
She won't last long.
Enough about her. You must fatten up. No more jumping in to help. That is only punished around here.
I know. I realize that now. As she said the words, part of her humanity eroded away. Natalia patted her shoulder.
Don't blame yourself. This place is broken, bad. Stay alive. That's all you have to do. Eat, sleep, and breathe.
If only it were that simple.
The good news is we haven't seen Nurse Gerlich since. We think she was sent somewhere else.
After the first hour of sitting, her panic began to rise like a fast-moving fever. She wanted to run like Marianne had, to dance, to move. She had to figure out how to manage this if she was going to survive. She'd read about monks in Asia who sat for hours and days at a time without moving. They'd lower their breathing until it was almost like they weren't alive, and somehow reach a transcendent state. How odd to think that they did it voluntarily, as a way of life. Maybe if she had something to focus upon. She considered her girlhood, the hours she'd traipsed the long paths that wound through meadows and wandered barefoot in the sand along the ocean. She settled on her mother's vegetable garden, and in her mind, explored it inch by inch. The golden ring of marigolds that kept the caterpillars away, the gangly stalks of Brussels sprouts, the squat cabbages all in a row. At one point, she picked up the heavy fragrance of the lilac bushes that stood along the far fence. The time flew by instead of crawling. Soon, instead of dreading the hours of sitting, she looked forward to the daily session as a way to escape the dreariness of the asylum. To replace the weak winter light that seeped in the barred windows with the image of a sun-drenched bed of pansies. After 3 weeks, Natalia linked arms as they stood at the end of a session. "I looked at you and you seemed so peaceful, like you were off somewhere else." "I was, in a sense." Sarah filled her in, and after the next time, Natalia described her own ruminations of her mother's vegetable garden in Tuscany. "We left when I was 5, so I didn't think I'd remember much. But it all came back, even the taste of a fresh tomato." On their walk together, each would take a turn sharing where they'd traveled during the day's session. They described in great detail their favorite dresses, songs, and books. And as the weather improved, Sarah's outlook did as well. As long as she spent the time looking backward and didn't think too far ahead, the panic in her throat remained a flutter instead of a roar. By the end of June, the ice and snow was a distant memory, as were her days at the Dakota, and the hope that Theo might come to her rescue. To her astonishment, the baby had survived Nurse Gerlich's onslaught and was active, especially at night. A few days earlier, she'd swapped dresses with one of the women in her ward, who'd lost a good deal of weight from the terrible diet. The new dress draped around her with plenty of room to spare. Natalia had given her a pointed look as they went into breakfast, but hadn't asked any questions. During the weekly bath, she used a towel to cover herself as she dipped in and out of the dirty water left by the other women. No one changed the water in between inmates, so if a woman got stuck at the end of the line, it was a brown soup. But Sarah deliberately hung back so the previous occupants of the tub would be busy dressing, and she could do her ablutions without an audience. One bright morning, she and Natalia waited with the others to get their daily work assignments.
"Mrs. Smythe and Mrs. Fabiano."
The nurse checked their names off on her clipboard.
"Report to the mat factory."
Natalia and Sarah shared a look of wonder. The factory was a move up for the more docile and well-behaved patients. Sarah stifled a squeal until they were outside, walking with the other women to the building that housed the workplaces, scrub brush making, mat making, and the laundry. The orderly pointed to a large, sunny room at the back, where rags had been piled on top of wooden tables.
"The others will show you how."
"At least we won't have to work with lye anymore," murmured Natalia.
Sarah's hands were raw from the soap, and she imagined the jar of hand cream that once stood on her bureau at the Dakota. She could picture it perfectly in her mind, the pretty label covered with faded roses. Hopefully Daisy had been able to take it so it hadn't been wasted. The thought made her sad. What had happened to her meager possessions? Had the spoils been divided up among the housemaids? Or had they been summarily tossed out or burned in the furnace?
"You are right," asked Natalia.
When Sarah's thoughts ran away like this, the darkness in her head would begin to grow, like a tumor.
She points in the direction of the work tables. Imagine, we even get our own stools to sit on.
Like a queen's throne.
They sat at a table near the window, and one of the women guided them through the process of ripping the rags into long shreds, coiling them up before stitching them around and around to create an oval. Sarah reveled in holding a thread and needle in her hand, the only sign that this was an asylum versus a true factory was the quiet gibberish that occasionally erupted from a few of the women.